Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Hey, listeners, thank you so much for joining me on the Negotiations Ninja podcast. Today is a special day. I've got the amazing and wonderful, the great and powerful Banachuk on the show. Yes, indeed, the mentalist, magician, man of all talents. He's here to talk all about all things mentalism and sales and negotiation and what we can learn from mentalists and his career in general about how to get better at sales, how to get better at negotiation. He has a storied history, and I'm giddy with excitement to share this with you because I think you're going to get so much out of it. It was such a pleasure, such a treat to have him on the show. Take some notes. Enjoy. Banachuk, how are you?
I am doing fantastic, my friend. How are you?
I'm so happy to have you on, man.
It's my pleasure, and I'm happy to be on.
Yeah, we're going to have a lot of fun today. For the people that have been living under a rock for the last 20 years, maybe you could tell them who you are and what you do.
Well, I have a long history. It's hard to condense everything that I do and everything that I've done. But to give you the basics, I am a mentalist. That means I take my five known senses to create the illusion of a sixth sense. And we can delve more into that later on. It just appears like I'm reading minds, but I'm not so sure anybody can. I run a $1 million foundation where I have $1 million for any psychic that can prove they have psychic abilities. Nobody's taken the money yet. It really started out as a young kid convincing scientists for 4 years that I was a genuine psychic. And there were reasons for that.
Amazing. I know you've done a lot of work with a number of different magicians throughout Vegas and a number of different tours. You yourself are a very successful magician / mentalist. I mean, is it fair to say that you are also a magician? I know a lot of mentalists don't like to be called magicians. Is it fair to say?
When I started out, I did not know there was a subcategory of magic called mentalism. I just knew that there were people that actually conned people into believing they had psychic powers. Now I'm well aware that that is a subcategory of magic. Most mentalists do not like people to think of them as magicians because it is a very different skill set. It's a very different sort of art form, but we're still using a lot of trickery, mostly trickery, that is taken from the magic world. The difference is that with a mentalist, you tend to look like you're a genuine psychic. With a magician, you kind of know you're seeing a magician unless you're from a third world country or the Dark Ages.
Awesome. To give you some background, a lot of our listeners are negotiation professionals. So crisis negotiators, people who talk people off of bridges, essentially, procurement negotiators, sales negotiators, all that kind of stuff. And whenever I think of mentalism, I always think, man, there's so many commonalities that exist between what you guys do and what we do, because essentially what we're trying to do is get people to agree to what we want or come to some sort of an agreement that makes sense.
Sure.
And there's a lot of misconceptions, I think, about what mentalism might be. What do you think is the most common misconception about mentalism?
Well, because of exactly what we do, we appear to read people's minds, right? So I'm telling them the birth dates. I'm telling them their social security numbers. I'm giving them the most intimate details about their life. Because of what we do and because of the presentation by some mentalists in the past, it appears not necessarily anymore that we're psychic, but many mentalists have gone into the whole NLP arena and they say they're doing everything by NLP, but a lie is a lie is a lie. There is no way you're going to get somebody's social security number or even their birth date by using NLP. It's just simply not true. And I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions about mentalism. Now, what's interesting about what we do as performers, because I think as every performer, not just a mentalist, but even a magician, we do use negotiation techniques continuously within our show to get people to comply with what we need them to do, where we need them to stand, how we need them to reply. You know, do we nod our head at the same time that we say something to get a positive feedback? And not just that, that magicians have to be their own salespeople. They have to negotiate and they have to get a higher fee. And it depends what market you're in. I've worked many different markets. You know, I've actually worked restaurants in my early days. And I always call it fan-fan technique. And it's find a need, fill a need. And that even goes back to the day when I fought the scientists. And I'll come back to that in just a little bit. I found a need and I filled the need. And I still use that need now to get free publicity all around the world. And, you know, I couldn't pay for the amount of publicity I get from those type of techniques. With the restaurants, when I was a young bachelor, I did what we call close-up magic, but it was more like close-up mentalism. Like I would bend forks, I would make things move at the table, I would read people's minds at the table. Most magicians, when they were doing it, when trying to sell themselves to a restaurant, they would go in there and say, yeah, I'm going to bring people in, you know, and they would give all these other reasons that I knew that they could not fulfill. When I went into the restaurant, I would say, look, I'm not going to probably create more people and more clients for you. You're already very, very busy. You don't really need that, but I'm going to fulfill a need for you. When people are waiting for their food, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to keep them entertained to the point that they wouldn't know that there was any time between the time that they took their order and the food came out. If you have an issue in the kitchen itself, then one of the things that I will do is I'll continue to perform at that table so they won't even realize the amount of time that has actually gone through. So I didn't make promises that I couldn't fulfill, because the moment you start making those promises, you're not going to be fulfill them. You're not going to be a last. And at the time, I was able to walk in at any particular time and work any single one of those restaurants and pay my bills. I also made sure that the restaurant paid me, so it was guaranteed money. I never worked off tips, and which is really unheard of. The reason I would do that is I wouldn't want to take money away from the wait staff. I wanted the wait staff to work with me. So if somebody would give me $1 or $2, I would say to them, no, keep your money. Now, if somebody handed me $100 or $50 or something like that, I would take that because I knew that those clients would be insulted. As a result of doing that and working with the wait staff worked with me. They knew I was not taking their tips. So they would bring me to the higher clients, the clients that actually had money, the clients that they wanted to keep happy. And as a result of that, I would also get bookings for my stage show from those clients, because most of those clients ran companies, they ran corporations. And even today, some of those clients I still work for as a result of that.
Amazing. How in the world did you get restaurant owners to agree to pay you? Because usually that's not a thing. Like an entertainer comes into a restaurant, you're working purely off of tips.
I would specifically say that. I said, you have a need here, you know, and I would show them the need I have. I would also work in with all my promo material. My promo material had newspaper articles from when I fooled the scientist, right? So I found a need, filled a need there, and I used everything that I got from there to book these as well. So I came in, and when I came in, it was a little bit different than any other magicians that were coming in, because I really had the credentials. They wanted me there. They could talk about me themselves. They could tell their clients, you know, their customers, their best customers, and hey, we've got this guy here who actually fooled the scientists. So I would also say that I don't want your customers to feel uncomfortable like they have to tip. I don't want to have to take any tips. But, you know, if you pay me X amount when I come in, then, you know, and it was minimal. It was really, really minimal. And they could see, because the fact that I would tell them, look, whenever you have a problem in the kitchen, they're not going to realize that, you know, there's a problem in the kitchen, because I'm going to keep them entertained. They're going to be happy no matter what. And a happy customer is important to them. That's value, right? That's value for them, because they know those customers are going to come back.
You could have had a great career in sales, man. I don't know why you're playing around with this mentalism thing.
Well, you know, I go back to the day, like let's go back to my very beginning, right? With the scientists, because I think that also allowed me to open up a lot of doors, because every market that I've been, I've been extremely successful. The college market, I work trade shows, I've worked banquets, I work evening shows, and I approach each one of these slightly different on how I sell to them. But I think I need to give a little bit of my real background for people to understand, you know, where I'm coming from. So when I was a kid, it was back in the 1980s, scientists had lamented for many years, there is no evidence of ESP under proper scientific control because of lack of funding. Very quickly, even at that young age, I thought it had nothing to do with the lack of funding. It had to do with their pro bias. In other words, they were not using real science to find out if it was genuine. They were basically just documenting what they already believed. And there was one other bias that was in the way. because they had PhDs, they wouldn't accept the expert help of somebody that could detect that trickery, a magician. They would think, okay, I'm too smart. There's no way I'm going to be fooled. So when Washington University in St. Louis was given $500,000 to study psychic phenomena by McDonnell Douglas, board chairman at McDonnell Aircraft, I saw a door open. So I went in there and I convinced them I could bend metal with my mind. I convinced them I had other psychic abilities. And after those 4 years, I came out and said it was all an illusion. And again, it's finding that need, right? And the need was, at that time, I was like, okay, there are other people like Uri Geller and other psychics at the time who were convinced them they're genuine. They need to be exposed as fakes, as frauds. And I filled that need by going in and convincing them that I was truly a genuine psychic. When we came out, I ended up getting news articles all over the world in every major magazine. And as a result, I was able to use that to later promote me. Even to this day, if I go into a town, I can get on almost any TV show. I can get on almost any radio program by simply saying, hey, the man that fooled the scientists.
Incredible. I love it, man. You know, as negotiators and mentalists, we use a lot of the same tools in reading body language, reading expressions on your face, reading micro expressions, all that kind of stuff. What do you think we as negotiators could learn from you guys that you do very well that maybe we don't do as well?
I think one of the best things that we do, a lot of people have asked me, where do you get your influence? You know, who was your role model? And I really had no role model. This answer usually comes in when they say, what would you recommend that I read or that I do? And I would just always tell them, watch the evangelists. You know, they create this roller coaster ride of emotion. They get people crying. They get people laughing. They're very charming. And that's what you need to learn. You need to know how to learn to make people like you. And that's where we get into mirroring and anchoring and things like that. Mentalists do it on a much more subtle level. Entertainers do it. Really good entertainers do it on a much more subtle level. When you're standing on stage and you're just looking straight ahead, nobody thinks you're looking at them. But if you look at every single area of the audience, every person in that audience feels like you actually paid attention to them, that you truly saw them out there. How many times do you hear people say, yeah, I went to this concert and, you know, and the big star on stage looked directly at me. And that's a feeling of emotion they feel. They feel like they were important. Make people feel important.
Yeah, I love that. I think one of the things that we lack when it comes to negotiation is we're so busy trying to think of the next thing that we're going to say that we're not actually paying attention to people. And when that happens, just like you say, we're not, you know, if we're not engaging them, we're not creating that eye contact, we're not creating that emotional level of connection, that's when we lose them.
There's a lot of controversy about mirroring, anchoring, and things like that, right? Those techniques cause you to pay attention. For those people who don't know what mirroring, it's basically what you do is you sit with a person and you kind of start copying exactly what the other person is doing. Not to the point to where it's creepy, but it's subtle. You sort of like echo their body language, their other type of nonverbal communications, how they move their hands, you know, if they put their heads to the side, certain sounds they might make, you know, the tone of the voice, you know, is it like the way that I'm speaking right now, which is very frenetic, or is it much more peaceful and slow? And when you start to do that, you're going to find out that people sort of have an empathy with you as well, because they feel like you're having an empathy with them. And there's been a lot of studies done on this. Basically, there's been studies done in speed dating, and the men or the women that use this technique were seen much more favorable as a result. There was a study done in 2009 on that. There was another study done where students would ask other students to write an essay for them. And if they sat there and they mirrored and they talked to the person in their same tone and used their body language, students were more likely to agree to write that essay for them. In sales, sales clerks get higher sales whenever they do that. Like, you just talk to the person, you speak to the person, you act the way that person is acting, and you're going to get higher sales. It's great for waitresses. They tend to increase their tips, you know, exponentially by using this. And it really came back in the 1990s at the University of Parma in Italy. There was a researcher there, and it happened quite by accident. He was sitting there, and he was reaching for his food. And the monkey's brain was hooked up to all kinds of equipment. And every time he did that, he realized that the neurons in the monkey's brain for that particular action, it wasn't just about the food, but it was the actual action of reaching for the food and picking up the food. They were stimulated. So in other words, it was almost as if the monkey itself was picking up the food as the researcher was picking up the fruit. So they went in this whole different direction of research, and it's now basically what we call mirror neurons, and this is something we start to use now. And you can start to take that and work with a person. You can sit there and you mirror their body language, and then you can almost start to control them. to get them to do the things that you want them to do, to get them to agree with the things that you want them to agree with. Because what you do is you take those actions and you start anchoring those actions that they have to positive stimuli, to good things. If you're a good salesperson, you won't just try to sell somebody a car. You'll sit there and you'll talk to them about their family. You'll talk to them about their grandfather, their dad. You'll talk to them about trips that they took when they were a kid in the car. So what you're doing is you're getting all these great feelings. And if there is anything negative, you turn it into something positive. Like me, when I was a kid, really, really little, I remember sitting in the back of the station wagon, laying in the back, looking up at the stars on long journeys. If I mention that to somebody, they'll say, yeah, I did too. Or they will give you some sort of positive feedback. So when you actually do go out in that car, you take a ride in a car with them for a test drive, they have these good feelings that are going on. And you're also using their body language as well during the conversation in the car. And you're going to increase your sales.
I totally agree with you. For the listeners, just when you're listening to Manacek talk about mirroring, the term that you want to look for when you're searching this, you can certainly search the term mirroring, but the technical term is called isopraxism. And when you do that, what you're essentially doing is you're creating this connection with the counterparty where they feel like they're more connected to you now because you're essentially doing the same thing. And what's crazy is that, I mean, you wouldn't think that this is a real thing, but studies have shown that it's absolutely true. One of the things that I think that you do very well is your ability to tell stories. How important do you think is the ability to tell good stories with arcs of conversation in them?
I don't think of myself as telling good stories, or maybe other people do, because I'm really bad about reading what other people think about me. But I just try to be really honest about anecdotes and things that have actually happened to me. And I try to put a little humor in there, but the humor is based in this situation. I tend to be very self-deprecating, and that's not on purpose. That just happens to be who I am as a human being. And I think by opening up like that with people and opening up emotionally with people and just being 100% honest about who and what I am, that makes people trust me. And it's not something that I'm doing to be manipulative. It is just sort of who I am. But I think people can learn from that as well and realize, look, if you seem open, you seem genuine, people are going to like you a little area. One thing I want to say about the mirroring the behavior is just so that people, when they actually do more research on that, basically what it comes down to is it's activating the exact same neurons in your brain that process rewards and the things that actually make you feel good, because they end up feeling good about themselves in that particular moment. Sorry, I just didn't want to leave that out.
No, that's good, because basically there's this release of dopamine when that happens, right?
Yes, exactly right. It's the same kind of thing when they say the greatest sound to a person, Carnegie said, that is a person's own name. So exactly the same feeling that you get.
Yeah, incredible. Given your career and given how successful you've been, certainly there must have been someone that you modeled yourself after throughout your career. Has there been someone that you looked up to that you modeled yourself after? Because I find that that's the quickest road to success. Find someone that you respect, model yourself after that.
I think it is, but in my case, no. My background's a little bit different. I was abandoned in England when I was 9 years old with two brothers a year and 3 years old. I raised them by myself till I was 15. I moved to the United States with my biological father, who I had found in Australia. He had a family already. There were issues with our family. While I was in high school, I moved out. I had three jobs, and I had my own place. My half-sister came to live with me for a while. So I was always taking care of somebody. So I really had to figure most of this stuff out myself. But it really came back to, like I said, that fan, find a need, you know, fill a need, really is what it comes down to. And I've seen that, and I've looked at that in many people. I have a good friend by the name of Eric Lambert, and I was very successful in the college market. I took Entertainer of the Year 2 years in a row, Novelty Entertainer of the Year, and it was actually in APCA, and it wasn't a setup thing because it was a voting thing. But there's another group called NACA, National Association for Campus Activities. And I remember going there one time, and in order to get a showcase, now a showcase is where you go on stage and all the college students come to these conventions, all the people that are buying and booking. I remember going there and I wanted to get a showcase. Well, you have to send in your videotape, and they had to vote on it. And they told me I had to contact this lady by the name of Charlotte. Now, it turns out Charlotte is the wife of the top mentalist in the college market at that particular time, Craig Cargest, right? And I'm thinking, this is not going to be good for me because Craig is the top medalist in the college market, and his wife is certainly not going to want him to have competition. There is no way I'm going to get a showcase. Well, the same kind of thing happened to Eric. So Eric took a look and he said, you know what? I'm going to start my own convention. So that's what he started doing, and he did it correctly. And I helped him in the early days, and he changed things a little bit. When you're going to do something, even if you're going to do something like that, you have to make it bigger or better. You know, otherwise, what's the point in doing it, right? Really, what's the point? So what Eric did, rather than you sending in your videotape and it getting voted on because he had the same experience that I had, he said that if you get a booth at APCA, Association of Promotion of Campus Activities, you automatically get a showcase, right? So it's sort of a win-win right there. It's what we try to do. You know, I do that when I'm booking trade shows, and I'll come back to that in just a second. You try to add value. You give people a reason to want to come to you. And every entertainer, what they really truly want is to do their wares, to get on stage, to perform in front of other students. So you're going to buy that booth. But that's a win-win because now Eric gets money as a result for his company by people buying the booths rather than just coming and being at somebody else's booth. So it was a win-win thing. But then I started creating one of the bad, I tend to hurt myself sometimes in business a little bit by being who I am. So I'm trying to separate my, it's why I have my manager do all my negotiations now, because I tend to give in to people very, very easily myself because I feel bad. So people would come to me because I was so successful in the college market, and they would say, how do I get in the college market, other entertainers? So I would help them. I would tell them about the signups, you know, the students that are coming into the booth aren't necessarily the students that are going to hire you. You need to have their supervisor, and you need to tell them to bring their supervisor over to come and see you. You need to let them know what time they're going to be in the office, because if you're selling yourself, you're going to be sitting there making all these phone calls at the wrong times, because most of the people that are doing the bookings and the hiring happen to be students themselves. So what's the best time to call? What's the worst possible time to call? You're going to want an evening, a dinner showcase, because the students go out and party any other time. But if it's a free dinner, the students are going to be coming to that particular show. So I started creating a lot of my own competition. And then I was writing books with my effects as well. And they were doing my material. Now, in the college market, there's a magazine that comes out. And it's sort of how it's voted for you to get the awards as well. And there's different areas. There's areas like for your road crew. There's an area for originality, entertainment value, and student response, and things like that. And the highest point you can get is 5 out of 5 stars. I was getting 5 out of 5 stars in every single area there until I started introducing other people into that particular marketplace. And then the one area I went down was originality. And why? Because students were...
Because everyone was copying you.
Exactly. The students were seeing my material being done by somebody else. So my area of originality went down.
You're a giver, man.
Yeah, that becomes a problem, right? Even like doing something like this, if I talk to you right now about trade shows and how I book trade shows and how I got into those, even just the action of doing that right now, which I'm okay with doing, I don't do trade shows anymore. But even the action of doing that creates competition. They hear this, they go, oh, I should be doing trade shows. But trade shows is not the best market now for magicians. It used to be a fantastic marketplace, but then so many other magicians started learning from other magicians and learning techniques and then coming in and underselling them. You know, the magic arena is just such a bad area for like camaraderie and the aspect of helping each other build up and to create a need and to raise your prices. We tend to undercut other performers, which is really, really sad.
Outside of the mirroring isopraxism thing, is there a tip that you could leave the listeners with today about how they could improve their negotiation skills where you think as mentalists, you've got it on lock?
I don't even know if it's necessarily as a mentalist. It's me personally. I've always tried to think outside of the box. It's that find a need, fill a need, and not just be like everybody else. And I'll give you an example because I have mentioned trade shows and I don't want to leave it off on that and not tell you about that. A lot of the trade show guys would go in and they would fight to get a meeting with somebody. And it's extremely, extremely difficult. So the way that I sold was I would find out who's in charge of booking the entertainment. I would say, look, All I need is 5 minutes of your time. I'm going to increase your booth flow and product awareness. I wouldn't tell them that I was a magician, because the moment I would tell them that, they would think, oh, just a magician. They've already had this preconceived notion. Now, who doesn't want you to increase their booth flow and their product awareness, right? So now I would get inside there and I would do my sales pitch. And usually they would have me there 20, 25, 30 minutes. Oh, they're asking me to do things for the other people in the building. Now, things that I would tell them is, I'm not going to sell myself. I'm going to sell the client. When people leave your booth, they're not going to remember me. What they're going to remember is what I did, but they're going to remember your company name. In fact, there was an interesting thing. One of the guys that used to work trade shows, he would always tell the company, look, I'm going to make a mistake of your name, but I'm going to turn around and look at it on the board up there. Because if I do that, people are going to be looking at the board and they're going to see your name and it's going to stick in their mind, because they're going to remember that I couldn't remember the name of your company. I'm doing it on purpose. It was a double thing, though, because what it allowed for him personally, it allowed him to let the people out there know that he didn't only work for that company, but he worked for other companies as well. What he said was absolutely true. It did implant the name of the company in the audience's mind, but it had a twofold thing that that company didn't necessarily know about. I would tell them, look, what do you normally do? And a lot of times I might say, well, we have a caricature sitting there. I go, well, that's fantastic. People walk away with a caricature. Maybe the name of your company is on that piece of paper. But really, that's not increasing booth flow, is it? In fact, it's stalling your booth flow. What's happening is you have people in a line waiting to get a caricature taken, and that's great. You got, it looks like there's people outside there, but what are your salespeople doing during that time? They can't really go sell to the people in line, because it's really awkward to talk to one person when somebody's behind him and if a line's moving down. I said, you won't have that problem with me. I'll be out there. I'll be doing 10-minute sets. I'll take 5 minutes off. I'll do 10-minute sets. That means I'm bringing in a group of people. I am talking about your company. I am doing a personal script about your company. Those people are going to think I'm a salesperson. I'm going to know your company better than your salespeople do. And then I'm going to turn them over to your salespeople and I'm going to create more people. You bring Oprah. How much are you going to pay for Oprah coming in there? Do you remember last time you saw Oprah? And this was back in the day when you saw Oprah in a booth. Do you remember what the name of the company was? No, you don't. All you remember is that Oprah was back in the corner of the trade show floor. With me, they're going to talk about me. They're going to talk about what I did. They're not going to know my name, but they're going to say he's in the Exxon booth or he's in the Lyondell Petrochemicals booth. So they're not going to be really talking about me. And then the other interesting thing that I used to do in the negotiation there, and you really want to do this with major companies. You don't do it with personal banquets and things like that, but you can to a point, is to break down every single thing that you're selling. You break it down, right? So you're charging for the microphone. You are charging for the podium. You are charging for every single one of these things. You're charging for the script. Is it a custom script? That means I'm going to have to get somebody to write it. I don't tell them that I might be writing it. And sometimes I do get help outside to help write a custom script. But even if it's not a custom script, they still pay royalties for the standard script. That's much less than the other. So they have areas to negotiate. So if they have an issue with price, you can say, well, you know what? If you provide the microphone or if you provide this, I don't have to charge for that.
Brilliant. I love this, because this, essentially what you're doing is you're creating opportunities for them to say, no, I don't want this, I don't want that. And essentially, you're still keeping your overall price fairly whole.
You are keeping it whole. And the other thing is, you offer them for multiple shows. Let's say they book you for an entire year, right? If you book me for every trade show you're doing this year, you give them a discount. But what you do is you make sure that you get a 50% non-refundable paid to you, because you never know what's going to happen. There may be somebody else that actually comes into that company and takes it over, and they might just say, okay, no more magicians, not even mentalists. You know, we don't want them anymore. But at least you've got 50% of that yearly fee at that point that's non-refundable to them. You should always get a 50% refundable anyway on any contract that you do.
Gold. This is pure gold, man.
The other thing I used to like to do with banquet managers was I would often take a banquet manager out to dinner. I would make the offer that if they took X amount of shows, they would get a single show free. They never, ever took me up on that, but it was always something that was in their mind, like I'm making that offer. And they can't receive kickbacks, banquet managers. So what I would always do was send them a gift. It might be a nice little video recorder. It might be a small little TV. It may be any one of those things, but something that they could actually have personally. They're allowed to accept them, but they can't actually accept a kickback money-wise.
Excellent. The power of reciprocity, man. That's what it is.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is.
Well, listen, man, as we close off here, is there any one thing that you could leave the listeners with to just say, hey, where can they find you online? Where do they find more of your stuff?
Yeah, the number one place they can find me, and we have episodes about everything and almost everything, but it usually has to do with the human mind in some way, from sexuality to business to just personal funny things. And that is BanachekSBrain.com. You can find me anything Banachek. That's BANACHE. Okay, there's one C in there. Just put that into Google and I will come up everywhere and anywhere for you.
Brilliant, man. Well, thank you so much for being on. I greatly appreciate it. I love your work. I love what you've done and the career that you've built. Thank you for sharing your wisdom with this listener base.
You are more than welcome. Thank you very, very much. I will see you around.
Hey friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go on to iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.